The Psychedologist.
Dr. Diana Quinn, naturopathic physician, ceremonialist, and end-of-life doula, comes on the show to talk about healing justice, nature, connection, language, and finding the way forward. Diana is a licensed naturopathic doctor and healing justice practitioner, specializing in integrative mental health, grief, and end-of-life care, and decolonized healing modalities. A queer mestiza Chicana, her work centers Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and the Two-Spirit LGBTQIA+ community. She offers monthly psychedelic integration circles for BIPOC and queer folks, entheogenic support for individuals and groups, and psychedelic education for healthcare professionals. She is a member of the Psychedelic Medicine Association, the Chacruna Institute for Psychedelic Plant Medicines, and the Queer Psychedelic Collective. For more information, visit drdianaquinn.com and follow her on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Okay, we're rolling.
Sounds good.
Oh, how are you?
I am doing really great. How are you today?
Yeah, I feel great, all things considered, and so that's it. Oh, is that a Harry Potter mug?
It is. Yeah, my Marauder's map.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, my half-sister wanted to go to Harry Potter World last summer, like the not COVID summer, the one before. And so, yeah, it was my first time back at Disney since I was three. It was pretty dysphoric in some ways, very commercial.
Yeah, for sure. I took my daughter when she was 11, so that was quite a few years ago at this point, but she was really into it and it was special for her and for us, you know, to have that experience. And then, I mean, in hindsight with, you know, J.K. Rowling kind of showing her ass, as it were.
Like, I'm kind of like, ass.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay. But, you know, those were special times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there will always be that. The time before I knew that J.K. Rowling was a TERF, yeah. And the time after.
Exactly. I liked it better when that was not part of the equation, but apparently it was always there. So, and, you know, in hindsight, all the things that kind of you can read into what was happening, it's like, oh, yeah. But there's no space for TERFs in my world today. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's okay. There are lots of fabulous affirming authors.
Indeed. Yeah.
So let's talk about you. Will you tell me what was your relationship to consciousness as you came up from being a child?
Yeah. So I think when I contemplate on my consciousness as a child and as a young person, what really kind of stands out for me was the primacy of my relationship to the natural world. Like, it really kind of was central to my imagination and to my sense of freedom and kind of like an inner world and just, you know, kind of a refuge and place of sanctuary. I had, you know, somewhat of a difficult childhood. And so I just, you know, kind of from the vantage point I have now as an adult and sort of understanding things differently, you know, kind of I look back on that time as really, you know, a period of co-regulation with nature. And, you know, I mean, I've kind of read a little about, you know, attachment theory and ecotherapy and how it's like, I mean, which I think is just this, you know, kind of like budding Western conceptualization of, like, you know, knowledge that Indigenous wisdom traditions have always had, but just that nature is alive and like the planet is living and it's actually very natural, especially for children to, you know, kind of have that relationship. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, it gets lost or it gets, you know, kind of intentionally severed or ruptured, you know, by virtue of the the way that, you know, our worlds are structured. And, you know, I also hold the vision that that is one way that the world has been constructed and certainly isn't the only way and can change. You know, and I, certainly everything that I stand for and work toward is, you know, bringing back that sense of kinship and relationship, where there's no real, you know, distinction, you know, in a sense between myself as, you know, kind of my inner experience and, you know, kind of the natural world as being, you know, the illusion of ourselves as these distinct, you know, individual beings, right? And like our sort of, you know, ego identities as being so hyper individualized, not, you know, certainly not certainly conducive to, you know, mental health or good sense of interdependence and, you know, kind of collaborative, cooperative living. So, yeah, so I definitely hold to, you know, ways of knowing and ways of being that are other than that. And I feel, you know, my childhood is very, very strongly immersed in that sort of sense of knowing. And my dog and the natural world were like, just, you know, kind of like the really kind of the ground of my sense of spirituality and, you know, kind of how I understand, you know, consciousness, you know, today even, right? But there was a long period in between where I sort of lost, got lost along the way. But yeah.
I was looking at your website before we connected today, and I just noticed how many trainings, like just how many schools of thought you've, I don't even know if they're schools of thought, but I was just like, oh, I love that person. Oh, you did this training too. And this one, like emergent strategy and generative or embodied somatics. Is that the res momenticum?
Abolitionist somatics.
Abolitionist somatics. Mm-hmm. Yep. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. There's many different places that you've learned from. So you went through a dark night of the soul kind of time or?
Yeah, I have. And, you know, also have had the privilege of many wonderful teachers and trainings and traditions like you're, you know, kind of speaking to. And, you know, it's kind of funny because I sometimes think of of myself as being like, you know, like kind of jack of all trades, master of none. Like I have like all of these various interests. And they all kind of like intersect and overlap. But it's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, kind of separate worlds and spheres that I have been formed and shaped by and moved through. And it's interesting that as time passes and the world is shifting, a lot of these interests are converging, you know, so even in terms of like, you know, my, you know, so the backdrop and foundation in, traditions of, you know, social justice and particularly healing justice, which is a whole praxis and, you know, kind of ideology that's deeply informed by Black feminist thought and activism in the South, you know, with Kara Page and other activists in the Kindred Southern Healing Justice Collective and Healing by Choice, which is a women of color and gender nonconforming healing justice collective that I've been part of for a number of years. So the foundation of the social justice movement as being, you know, kind of like the continuous thread that kind of runs through all of the different spheres and work that I do with somatics and with end of life care and, you know, death doula and grief work and psychedelics and, you know, traditional healing modalities and all of it, you know, kind of overlap and are, you know, kind of like intermingle. But it's so interesting kind of over the past year in particular with Zoom calls, because that's how life is. you know, having parallel conversations in all of these spheres, where people, you know, kind of didn't necessarily, you know, kind of know one another or move together, but they're starting to more so. So it's really kind of fascinating. And I'm kind of starting to get a sense of how my work in, you know, kind of like these slightly different, you know, kind of pockets professionally or, you know, spheres in terms of trainings and services that I've offered are, you know, kind of coalescing and coming together. So like the continuous thread, and this kind of ties back to even, you know, sort of what I was speaking to about childhood and consciousness, is like the sense of, you know, what Gloria Anzaldúa called nepantla, like the in-between, the Nahuatl term, you know, that she worked with in her writing to describe like liminal spaces, and, you know, particularly for queer folks, for gender nonconforming folks, for people of color, for folks who have to have, you know, dual awareness, right, of like the dominant, you know, kind of paradigm, and also our own lived experience, and, you know, the capacity to sort of move between worlds, you know, that aspect, which, I mean, that to me is like, that's what I grew up understanding, like it's sort of baked in, and the ability just, you know, with regards to that sort of dark night of the soul that you mentioned, you know, to be able to accompany folks, right, who are traversing difficult terrain, you know, having been through, you know, our own difficulty and our own healing processes and our own deaths and rebirths and, you know, kind of regenerative paths, I think is, you know, kind of a necessary ingredient to, you know, really be able to show up. And of course, the healing path is never complete. Like, I mean, it's ongoing. So I'm like, which dark night of the soul do you mean? No.
Yeah, I hear everything you're saying so much. Something I was reflecting on while you were speaking was about how I think to have a thread, or it's like stronger than a thread, it's kind of the opposite of a thread, but an intersectional framework, a social justice framework, anti-oppression, that if this isn't present in movements like the psychedelics movement, they're not rooted, right? It's kind of like floating. Part of the resilience of movements, I think, relies on the people to be grounded in their own self and their, you know, who they are, where they come from, and then also us to be grounded together in what are we actually doing here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I will say that there are more spaces where these conversations are taking place, and that's great. And also, largely, it's still, you know, sort of at the margins, you know, and still there's like DEI committees and then the whole organization. I mean, like, this is still, I think, kind of fundamentally the way that, you know, kind of like larger movements are operating. I mean, I'm seeing things shift. I mean, just in this past year, having more conversations about anti-racism and intersectionality in professional spaces, where, I mean, I had historically kind of just kind of gone my own way, because that's not what was being discussed in the, you know, kind of broader, you know, kind of profession. I mean, within the naturopathic profession or integrative medicine, which is, you know, I've been a naturopathic doctor for, you know, over 15 years now, and that has been, you know, kind of a huge piece of the work that I've done. But I've also kind of moved away from the ways in which that field has really kind of reproduced a lot of systems of harm, and, you know, really as a component of the medical industrial complex, although, you know, kind of it holds itself as being alternative in a sense. I mean, there's very much a lot of, you know, those The messages are, you know, deeply ableist and, you know, very much permeated with white supremacist ideology. So, you know, in the past year, you know, beginning to have conversations within those professional spaces where, you know, kind of the, you know, kind of mass, not the BIPOC folks, right? Because we've always kind of had our, you know, own experience and perspective, but within, you know, kind of a, that as an example, you know, that's pretty parallel to psychedelic spaces being predominantly white and, you know, kind of like outside of mainstream in a sense, you know, so, and, you know, kind of even same with end of life care, you know, spaces like death cafes and end of life doula, you know, spaces, like a lot of conversations, you know, in this past year with predominantly white folks who, you know, kind of would describe themselves as liberal, progressive, like, you know, in all these like overlapping spheres, like starting to realize, oh, there's a lot, you know, of work that we have to do. So, yeah, I mean, I absolutely believe that, yeah, like I'm seeing that those conversations take place more in psychedelic spaces. And it's still like a little bit of like a special interest like topic, right? For the most part, right? And like the, you know, the medicalization and corporatization and like all of the spheres of power really that are sort of moving, you know, things forward, are operating within the structures and systems that be, right? You know, so there's also a lot happening, you know, underground. There's a lot happening grassroots. There's a lot happening with people who are, you know, resisting those narratives. And I think that's awesome. Because, you know, like if our folks have not and continue to not be included in the conversation, like at the table making the decisions, if the care isn't designed with our community's needs in mind, then we need to create our own, you know, kind of networks of care, right? So, yeah. So, but that's what I'm, you know, hugely passionate about within work in psychedelic assisted therapy and working with entheogens is, you know, specifically access, specifically, you know, safe spaces for BIPOC and two-spirit LGBTQ folks to, you know, have access and have spaces for community care, for collective healing work, right, to come together.
Mm-hmm. And you've been holding a BIPOC integration circle.
Yeah, right? It's a monthly circle. It's free. It's been really lovely. It's, you know, again, we're meeting over Zoom and folks from all over the country come together and it's a, you know, lightly facilitated space. We do some grounding and embodiment practices together and everyone has the opportunity to share whatever is on their heart about their experience. And it's just been really nutritive and super supportive and like really kind of cultivated a lot of lovely relationships with folks who have been in attendance. And I'm starting later this month, we'll have our first of what will now be our intention is to offer monthly a queer psychedelic integration circle as well. And that's part of kind of a collective effort that I'm organizing with a network of folks, colleagues of mine. And the first session, I think you know Jen Thompson, you interviewed mm-hmm. them previously. So the two of us are co-facilitating. So that'll also be a monthly space that we're offering folks.
Mm, that sounds great. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you've learned in 15 years of being a naturopathic doctor. Like, just was there any big change in the way that you saw things during that time? Probably, but I don't know.
Yeah, I guess like the biggest change is that I found it was such a rewarding path. And I mean, it was many, many years of effort to, you know, kind of achieve the training and licensing. And, you know, I mean, I started pre-med classes, you know, in like the like mid-90s. I mean, like, so I was, you know, taking pre-med classes and then 5 years of naturopathic school. And I mean, it was a lot of labor of love, right? And then, but I think after, you know, kind of being in practice for quite some time, what for myself, and this is not a reflection on, you know, the profession as a whole, which has its issues, but for me, what I kind of came to understand is that even though the principles and foundations of that profession, which are really, you know, beautiful precepts like, you know, treat the whole person, identify and treat the cause, it's really, you know, getting to the root of imbalance and issues. But there was still this aspect of me as the expert and the patient coming in, even though like the whole kind of foundation of how it I was, you know, trying to frame and kind of set up my work was, you know, to be empowering, to provide information and resources and, you know, a variety of options and, you know, really kind of create something collaboratively. It's still like there was still this, you know, kind of hierarchy or imbalance of power just like embedded in the way that, you know, I came together with folks that I just didn't really resonate with. And I am actually very much about decentralizing and demystifying healing. Like it's not something that, I mean, sure, there's information and there's resources and you know, people who have dedicated time and labor, you know, to the study of. But I think for me, after being in practice for, you know, a fairly long time, and even just after changing the structure of my practice, I just kind of kept running into that as like something still isn't quite right, you know. So really moving a little bit even further away and starting to study and train with a number of teachers in the healing, traditional healing arts of Mexico that are, you know, commonly called curanderismo. You know, I understand that like the thing that really drew me to study naturopathic medicine in the first place was really this. Like this has been the path that I've always been on. It's just that there I, you know, grew up in a second generation Mexican American family that had been deeply, you know, assimilated and acculturated and, you know, by necessity for survival, and lost a lot of the, you know, kind of traditions of the culture and didn't have, you know, kind of an auntie or, you know, abuela or someone who, you know, in my known lineage, you know, kind of who kind of I could learn, you know, some of these things from. And so so I think, you know, kind of in hindsight, it's like all of, I mean, it all makes sense, like kind of looking back, all of the, you know, kind of steps along the path. But I'm feeling now like it's more of a, for me, the way that I understand it for myself in my own life is that you know, it's a calling and sort of a dedication. It's not a career, like it's not a profession. I mean, and it's also complicated because we live in capitalism and you have to make a living like in order to survive, right? But yet like some of these, you know, ways of practicing care and offering, you know, healing modalities and medicine like strictly lie outside of those forms of transactional exchange, you know, like deliberately and explicitly, because like those kinds of transactions, you know, kind of damage the integrity of the work, right? So yeah, so it's really changed and evolved a lot the way that I practice. I've really actually moved away from, you know, altogether kind of a typical naturopathic practice. And you know, kind of at this point, other than maintaining a license for, you know, a potential segue into doing psychedelic assisted therapy, which is a piece that I'm, you know, kind of holding and waiting to see kind of how things evolve and open up, you know, because again, my dedication is really kind of working at the community level. And a lot of the opportunities for working within the field clinically, you know, kind of really still have obstacles to access, you know, embedded. So, you know, still working out what that will look like. But yeah, so this is kind of like the trajectory, the the career trajectory that I've been on that's been unexpected and unusual. But I found that, you know, kind of when I saw the, you know, kind of job description for, you know, doing this kind of work, I was like, oh, this is what I've been, you know, in training for all along, you know, in a sense. So,
yeah, I think that that distinction between our calling and what we're studying is important to take a look at. I think my calling was as a person who helps others connect with others and with themselves, and it's something like a healer in different ways. And yet for so long, I was like, I'm a psychologist. I'm studying psychology. I'm going to be a therapist. And then when that wasn't working out, it felt very confusing. And what I couldn't realize is that what I was seeing, the way that psychology was done, didn't resonate, but I hadn't developed enough of my own confidence in my perspective to, you know, it had to be me who was wrong, not them. And so then kind of stepping back from that and learning other things, psychedelics impacting me greatly, and a lot of travel, and also, I think, contending with the trauma of the oppressor, as April Dawn Harder calls it. That all, now I think I can sit back in the seat and be like, what parts of the field are still workable, and could I still do my calling from, mm-hmm. you know, within capitalism. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I like that you made that distinction. And I was wondering if you had any advice or wisdom to share for people who have ancestors, we all do, but who don't have a living ancestor with connection to the roots. And maybe it's a few generations away, or maybe it's so many that the person can't even begin to know where to trace it. But we can do it. You know, it's so important to do, I think. Any words for someone like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I think it's so complex. I think the layers of what we many times need to tease out in doing work with our ancestral lineages, and you know, speaking for myself, you know, in my experience, a lot of what was formative for me in terms of my immediate nuclear family of origin, and, you know, extended family, and a lot of the things that I experienced and I saw, you know, kind of affecting the generations that I have known contact with. It wasn't until many years later, and, you know, a lot of therapy, a lot of, you know, various different forms of, you know, kind of trauma healing modalities, that I started to begin contextualizing all of those experiences within kind of a larger framework of historical trauma. And that it's mm-hmm. like, it seems so obvious now, but it really wasn't at all at the time, and, you know, for many years. And so, you know, so for myself, you know, kind of beginning to really comprehend that a lot of the healing work that I had to do, really kind of taking it out of the personal, in a sense. I mean, of course, it was deeply personal and is, right? And we're the way in which we, you know, I had to, you know, kind of do my own healing work, which really led me to relationship with healers that were that invited me into ceremony, which really, you know, kind of is what opened up my relationship with plant medicine and kind of put me on this path, right, to begin with, which I didn't expect. It wasn't like I was looking for that. But what resulted, you know, for myself in those experiences was part of the, not only healing myself on a personal level, but doing a lot of the healing work for my lineage. And really, you know, one of my teachers calls it naming the beast, right? And it's like understanding what it is you're dealing with, because it's not just yours, right? And I mean, I'm talking, you know, specifically for BIPOC folk, you know, who carry, you know, historical trauma in a specific way. And, you know, for white bodied folks, like you said, you know, there's trauma and it's of a different, you know, kind of, shape and, you know, variety. Right. And we have different work to do. But, you know, what I, came to understand was, you know, I was doing lineage work and started doing that really proactively and intentionally. Some of that, you know, had to do with, doing genealogy, doing, you know, kind of ancestry, you know, kind of research. But so much of it can't be traced. I mean, it's like lost, you know, and in my particular case, you know, being mestiza, there's interrupted indigenous lineage, but I can't claim indigeneity. I don't have access to, you know, it can be part of my story. That's not, you know, my narrative and my experience, right? And so I think there's also this careful walk of being very mindful about what we can claim or reclaim, right? You know, because it's complex, right? And so, you know, in the work that I do with clients, supporting folks who are doing ancestor work, and seeking, you know, routes to connection. And some of that's through research, you know, genealogical research, genetics, stories. Some of it's through non-ordinary consciousness, non-ordinary, you know, kind of awareness, you know, making contact and connection, or, you know, developing an altar practice or other, you know, ancestral reverence practices. Because there's a certain way in which, you know, for many folks, Black, Indigenous, and people of color in particular, access, you know, was intentionally severed, right? Like in a lot of cases, you know, to those histories and lineages. And, you know, for a lot of complex reasons, whether it be through, you know, adoption or migration or the transatlantic slave trade or what have you, you know, like folks don't know where their people are from, can't know. So, and yet all of the both epigenetic, you know, kind of like historical trauma and resilience and brilliance and, you know, knowledge is all there, right? Like we're literally the walking embodiment of, you know, our ancestral lineages. And so much of the time, just doing self-care practices, right, is the work, right? It's not like out there. It's actually, you know, kind of in here. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers. There's so much that could be said about doing it.
Oh no, totally. I was just trying to find this quote and I'm not going to try right now, but it's from Farming While Black by Leah Penniman. And it's like, we are our ancestors' wildest dreams, who are our ancestors who braided seeds into their hair of hope to be sovereign on land once again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Her work is so beautiful. And yeah, I think that sums it up so beautifully. I mean, I was privileged to attend a decolonizing week of workshop experience that she co-facilitated along with Michael Yellowbird and a number of other folks.
Oh, he, oh, his episode yeah. is going to come out
he
before
is a
yours.
Wonderful mentor and colleague and friend of mine. And in name more than really in practice, I'm a fellow of his Mindful Decolonization Center at the University of Manitoba. I've been privileged to publish and co-author an article with him, and we're hoping to do some more work together. But he was very influential in a lot of my, research and, conceptualization of what he calls, what he, coined neurodecolonization, and really, the somatic and, neuroplasticity of, right, reshaping our thinking and concept of self and community and, decolonization is such an overused term, and I kind of try to avoid it. But in what he's talking about, right, it's more, deconstructing a lot of the conditioning of our thinking. And, back to what you're saying about the psychedelic movement, it's like, this is what we need. This is one of the ways that, psychedelics are just one of many different tools. And, he's a great example of someone who writes about, other forms of mindfulness and, indigenous practices that were, essentially altering consciousness and, producing specific changes, neurological changes that shape, our concept of awareness and reality. So it's like, if the goal is, it's an opening, right? So that's what entheogens and what these different practices produce. And then it's what are we going to do with that opening, right? That's like the praxis of it, whether it's, and it's embodied, right? So again, going back to somatic abolitionism or emergent strategy or generative somatics or any of these, modalities, which we're talking about, it's like, it's what you practice day in and day out that you become that is really, how you're showing up. So ideologically and in terms of belief, that might be shifting, but until, it translates into embodied practice and how we're, physically showing up, it's a work in progress. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes me think of accountability and thinking about accountability the last few years. And I had my sights on grand accountability of myself and others. And now it's like, okay, I'll just focus on being accountable with my partner and like my family, not even just like really zero in on the close relationships and practice in small ways there, little accountability processes, because when something really big happens, we don't have that muscle and that pathway to actually be embodied in it. And then it can cause mm-hmm. even more harm.
Absolutely.
I've got something coming out of left field. This has actually never happened to me while I was talking to someone for the podcast, but I swear it's like marijuana is tugging on my shoulder and being like, ask her about marijuana. Like, what do you think about marijuana?
That's interesting. I don't really have much of a relationship with marijuana at this point in my life. I guess the things that I think about when you bring that up are, how are we going to, as the decriminalization movement expands, as mainstreaming progresses, how are we going to prevent psychedelics from reproducing what the legalization of marijuana has done, right? Because what we have is, these vast disparities and, these vast disparities in criminalization and, Black and brown people incarcerated for drug-related offenses. And then, the cannabis corporate world, right?
Kings.
Just making tremendous amounts of wealth. And I just see like a lot of those same players, you know, kind of positioning themselves to, you know, just take this and run. So, I mean, I guess that's the only thing that really comes to mind. I don't personally have, I mean, I have in my life, but, you know, at present, that's not a medicine that I have a strong relationship with. But I think just in terms of, we know what that looks like. And I mean, it appears as though a lot of the players in the field are, you know, kind of trying to move in, you know, similar ways. So I would like to not see that happen. you know, so.
Yeah. No, there are so many levels to not see it happen, like that. I hope not to see it happen too. I guess what maybe why it's coming up for me is because since I had COVID, I had all these aches for like weeks. And so I was like taking edibles every day because it helped so much with the aches. And now I don't have COVID anymore. I feel fine, but I'm still like working with it every day. And I just wonder about, I guess, the energy that I'm using it with, the energy that it's coming with the medicine, because, right, like the dispensaries, the energy that I think some of that cannabis is being grown with is like, is to keep generating revenue. You know, it's like really a huge market. And having studied herbalism 2 years ago and thinking about how herbs are produced and like, even just beyond organic or not means, I don't know. I guess thinking about psychedelics, while I think that the plants and the medicines themselves are not inherently like good or bad, and maybe some really want to help us and stand to do that, in human hands, we could totally fuck it up.
Yeah. And I mean, I also think too, just about the cultivation and hybridization that has taken place with marijuana in terms of like how far away, you know, it is what it is, but, you know, trajectory and all of the different, you know, kind of varieties and so on. But I mean, from what I understand in terms of, you know, potency or quantity of THC that's present and so on, it's so dramatically different, which, you know, and not to say like, you know, good or bad or right or wrong, but it's like, as someone who also, you know, as an herbalist and sort of appreciator of nature's wisdom, and just the concept in general of monoculture or, you know, plants and their medicine just overall. I mean, I certainly have worked with cannabis medically, you know, as a recommendation to patients, and mostly CBD, you know, and there are a lot of cases where folks have gotten really, you know, good results with that as sort of an anti-inflammatory and cortisol regulator and immune modulator. And it's got a lot of really wonderful properties. And in the past, working with cancer patients, you know, THC obviously has tremendous, you know, kind of medicine to offer for folks. But also, like, there are so many other plants. I mean, there are so many other immune modulators and anti-inflammatories. It's like, why this one, right? And it's just such a, to me, that's always kind of a red flag, because it's, and even just, you know, kind of thinking about psychedelics in general. And I mean, not to say again that anything is, you know, kind of like good or bad or right or wrong, but just as an observation, there are so many medicinal plants that have such profound properties for impacting our consciousness, you know, for, you know, kind of helping to bring us into balance, that we can be in relationship with. And what's coming to my mind as I'm saying that is something that I heard Dawn Davis say in an interview, where she said, you know, we're not taking care of our water. Why are we having these conversations about these, you know, sacred plants and particularly endangered ones? Like, let's start with the basics. And, you know, I mean, I think that there's so many ways in which, if we're moving with, you know, with an extractive relationship, you know, in terms of like, what can I take? What, you know, plant can I take? What psychedelic can I take? Like, it's not, I mean, I think that what I'm interested in is just kind of like a broader, you know, sort of paradigm shift that, that is more about relationship and just about the, you know, sort of innate value and integrity and sentience, you know, of the plant, of the fungi, of the cactus, of the, you know, being of whatever kind we're speaking of, and less about how can it serve me, right? Because that's just, you know, one of the things that I just notice, you know, and this sort of parallel between what's happening, you know, kind of in terms of like psychedelics and, you know, the parallel with the cannabis industry reminds me of that same sort of grasping, you know, kind of energy. So, I mean, I'd like to not put my attention and energy on that, you know, kind of as a direction. In terms of, you know, especially plant teachers. And, you know, I know folks, for example, who are cultivating their own mushrooms, you know, develop a really different relationship with them, right? You know, so there are different ways of moving, you know, I think in terms of how we're relating to plant medicines as a whole. And I know a lot of folks, you know, are of the mind that, well, these substances will open everyone up to greater compassion and, you know, eco-consciousness and, you know, shift our, you know, kind of motivation toward a more, you know, kind of earth-friendly consciousness. And I don't know. I don't think that that's necessarily something I'm holding my breath on, right?
There was a guy wasn't there some horns? Guy wearing yeah. horns in so the White House like this week?
That's just not really what they're capable of doing for us. So, yeah.
And kind of brings me back to one of the things you said right at the beginning about co-regulating with nature. And it's like seeing that nature is like our family and home. It's there's a connection and an interconnection. And I think approaching medicine that way is good. It's not an inanimate thing that I take. It's like it has a consciousness. And what's the intention I'm taking it with? And how am I giving back to you know, where's the reciprocity in that relationship?
And yeah, I mean, that's certainly the approach that I've learned in the context where I've been honored and privileged to, you know, participate in Indigenous ceremony. It's like, this is a medicine, this is a teacher, and it's a, you know, it's a sacrament. It's something that you, you know, is a being, right? And that's a very different conceptualization, and I, you know, for myself, am trying to move toward greater, you know, sort of awareness of that way of thinking with the natural world, you know, as a whole, right? And I think that it makes me think about Robin Wall Kimmerer and you know her concepts of kinship and you know kind of what she's kind of written on the subject.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of that earlier when I think she says that 70% of, I don't know if it was Indigenous languages as a whole or her language, but they are like action centered and not noun centered. It's not, a lot of those words aren't about things. They're about what happens, like the mushroom pushing itself up out of the earth.
It's a completely different, I mean, thinking about the ways that language shapes consciousness and is sort of the template and, you know, kind of foundation for, you know, through which we think, right, and speak and, you know, kind of act. It's just so, so fundamentally different of a worldview that, you know, kind of is generated by, you know, that way of communicating. So pretty inspiring. And it makes me wonder, you know, colonizer languages don't know if, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to get there? how are we, you know, what kind of imagination, like radical imagination is necessary, you know, to kind of open up more spaces in the framework that we have, that we're working within, the template that we have, right? Which is very, you know, kind of objectifying and individualistic. You know, how do we, you know, build more in? And yeah, I know I recall, I think it was an interview that she gave Kimmer, where she was, you know, talking about using the term, I think it's ki, which is from, I think it's either Ojibwe or a different Anishinaabe language. And rather than referring to a tree as it, you know, kind of giving it a, you know, kind of gender neutral, like pronoun, right? You know, kind of referring to beings as they, right? Like, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I like that too. I like that so much. Well, I wish that I could just talk to you all day. Alas. Would you share as a closing what your consciousness hack is?
Yeah, you know, there's a few things that, you know, kind of come to mind with that question. And I'm contemplating, you know, the best response. And, you know, I think the thing that I'll, you know, kind of share is I listened to a previous episode where you were having a conversation with Reishi, I think the person's name was, about, you know, some of the adaptogens mm-hmm. and, you know, kind of the stamet stack and, you know, kind of offering some alternatives. So, you know, I was really into that conversation because I have explored a number of different herbs in conjunction with microdosing psilocybin and bacopa and chaga and turmeric, and certainly lion's mane and other, you know, kind of adaptogenic mushrooms are on the list. And I have like a daily tea mix that I made myself, which is powders of chaga, dandelion and burdock root, a little bit of maca, and then sometimes just like a little, you know, kind of pinch of a psilocybin microdose to add to it. So that is a really, I find, you know, kind of supportive, cognitive enhancing, creativity enhancing, replenishing and nourishing, and really grounding blend. So, you know, for me, that kind of is what is feeling good right now. I'm feeling like adrenal support and grounding are super critical right now. Like I need that, like, cause it's just, these are intense yeah. times, you know? So for myself, it's kind of like this combination of mm-hmm. what feels really nutritive and earthy and grounding, and also, you know, kind of holds out just a little bit of, you know, spark of hope, or, you know, kind of optimism, or, I mean, optimism isn't even the right word, but it's just kind of the knowing that, you know, we'll, you know, get through this one way or another. I mean, this is a dramatic time of shifting. And I know, you know, when we spoke previously, we were talking a little bit about the astrology of the times, and that's a whole other conversation that could be an hour long, but, you know, just, you know, in terms of the, you know, kind of big picture, you know, like Aztec Mexica calendar and the changing of, you know, the suns and all of the ways that we're moving through, you know, this incredibly transformative time. And we're seeing, obviously, in real time, just like how intense this is. You know, we really need nourishment and fortification, right? And to take care of each other. So that's that's my hack.
Thank you for taking care of so many and taking care of yourself while you do it.
Thanks so much for having me.
We need you.
Julia, pleasure and joy to talk with you today.
The Psychedologist is Consciousness Positive Radio. Find us everywhere podcasts are hosted. For more information, visit us on Facebook or online at thepsychedologist.com.